Welcome to today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, March 9th, 2025. We open with the New York Times trilobite, posted on February 17th, 2025, entitled, Hummingbirds Living in a Hive Found for the First Time. In a remote mountain cave in Ecuador, hummingbirds were discovered sleeping and nesting together. By Rachel Neuer. Hummingbirds are tiny and delicate, but don't be fooled. They are among the most aggressive birds in the avian kingdom. Their territorial furor is especially aimed at other hummingbirds. Competition over a patch of flowers or a mate often results in high-speed aerial chases, dive bombing, and beak jousting. So when Gustavo Cañas Valle, an ornithologist and birding guide, stumbled across a cave full of hummingbirds nesting and roosting together in Ecuador's high Andes, he could hardly believe it. I thought, this looks like a colony, Mr. Cañas Valle said. He added, they were like bees. He documented 23 adult birds and 4 chicks, all of the subspecies Oreotrochilus, Chimborazo, Chimborazo, commonly known as the Chimborazo Hill Star. Mr. Cañas Valle's discovery, described in the journal Ornithology in November 2024, may be the first documented example of hummingbirds that nested and roosted communally. It is also notable that he found the birds engaging in both these behaviors in the same space, something that even highly social species from other bird families tend not to do. Juan Luis Buzat, an evolutionary geneticist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, and another author of the study, who is also Mr. Cañas Valle's former graduate advisor, said the finding raised fascinating questions about the role environmental factors can play in driving group living and in promoting the evolution of certain social traits. Dr. Buzat and Mr. Cañas Valle at first hypothesized that harsh environmental conditions along the Chimborazo volcano, where they found the nests, had forced the birds together. The birds live more than 12,000 feet above sea level on a sparsely vegetated slope where it is hard to come by nectar-providing flowers, water, or shelter from freezing temperatures and biting winds. Either you aggregate or perish, Dr. Buzat said. But this may not be the full story. Mr. Cañas Valle explored the region and found 6 other examples of hummingbirds nesting and roosting together. He and Dr. Buzat also surveyed concrete drainage pipes scattered around the area. The pipes had similar environmental conditions to the cave, but could fit only 1 or 2 nests. The researchers found that just 45% of the pipes were occupied by nesting females, significantly lower than the frequency expected by chance, according to computer simulations the authors conducted. There were significantly more nests found in groups, on the other hand, than there would have been if randomly predicted. Of the 74 total nests Mr. Cañas Valle documented, 82% were part of groups. Together, these findings implied that the birds were actively choosing group living over nesting alone. Dr. Buzat suspects that environmental factors originally caused the birds to aggregate, but that once they bunched together, they evolved traits that made them more social, helping them adapt to their environment. I was very surprised to read about a truly colonial hummingbird, because most are aggressive and intolerant of others of the same species, said Scott Robinson, an ornithologist at the Florida Museum of Natural History, who was not involved in the work. No one would have considered a hummingbird a candidate for coloniality. Charles Brown, a behavioral ecologist at the University of Tulsa, who also was not involved in the research, said he was not convinced, however, that the hummingbirds observed in the study actually qualified as being colonial. Animals that live in true colonies often behave in ways that benefit their neighbors, Dr. Brown said, such as working together to find food or detect predators. While it was interesting to find hummingbirds in close quarters, There was no evidence of any social behavior on the parts of the animals nesting in these clusters, he said. Mr. Cañas Valle pointed out, however, that he observed the hummingbirds from the cave departing and returning together, suggesting a cohesive social group. It's not that each one was doing their own thing, Dr. Buzat said. But the authors agree that more research is needed. They hope to conduct behavioral studies to determine if the hummingbirds are merely tolerating each other or are actively cooperating. They would also like to conduct surveys for other hummingbird species in similar high Andes environments to see if they are engaging in group living, too. I'm sure there are other unknown caves in the mountains where hummingbirds live, Mr. Cañas Valle said. I'm expecting to find other species, for sure. Hummingbirds living in a hive found for the first time in a remote mountain cave in Ecuador. And now, the staggering success of vaccines. From Innovations in Solutions for Health Equity in the November 2024 issue of Scientific American, we look at why vaccines have been aiding health equity for 200 years and why today they are poised to save even more lives from more diseases. By Tara Hale. A May study in the journal Lancet estimated that vaccines against 14 common pathogens have saved 154 million lives over the past 5 decades, at a rate of 6 lives every minute. Vaccines have cut infant mortality by 40% globally and by more than 50% in Africa. Throughout history, vaccines have saved more lives than almost any other intervention, and vaccines' promotion of health equity goes far beyond preventing death. The Lancet study found that each life saved through immunization resulted in an average 66 years of full health without the long-term problems that many diseases cause. Vaccines play a role in nearly every measurement of health equity, from improving access to care to reducing disability and long-term morbidity to preventing loss of labor and the death of caretakers. We say vaccines are one of humanity's great achievements in terms of having furthered the lifespan and life quality for humanity in the past 50 years, says the chief program officer at Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, a public-private partnership that works to ensure low- and middle-income countries have access to vaccines against more than 20 infectious diseases. Every country in the world has an immunization program, thanks to the World Health Organization's Expanded Program on Immunization, or EPI, which was established in 1974. Every single country and territory has access to at least some vaccines, says Kate O'Brien, director of the WHO's Immunization, Vaccines, and Biologicals Department. Poverty, malnutrition, underlying health conditions, overcrowding, human conflict, displacement, and lack of access to medical care, hygiene, or sanitation. All of these are risk factors for infectious disease, O'Brien says. Vaccines' ability to reduce disease in the settings most plagued by these problems gives them disproportionate power to improve equity. Millions and millions saved. The Essential Program on Immunization, developed in 1974 by the World Health Organization, with the goal of vaccinating children in every country against 6 diseases, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, polio, measles, and a form of tuberculosis. In the 50 years since, it has grown to include immunization against 7 additional infections, HIV, hepatitis B, rubella, pneumonia, rotavirus, human papilloma virus, or HPV, and for adults, COVID. Additionally, organizations such as Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, have run vaccination campaigns against other diseases, including malaria, Ebola, and cholera. The cumulative efforts to vaccinate the world over the past half a century have saved more lives than nearly any other health intervention to date. A study published in The Lancet calculated the global impact of worldwide vaccination by modeling the averted deaths that could have been caused by 14 major pathogens in 194 World Health Organization member states from 1974 to 2024, including most of those in the current EPI program. The magnitude of the results is striking, yet they still underestimate the true impact because the study did not include vaccines for COVID, influenza, HPV, malaria, Ebola, or several others known to reduce mortality. Even so, the authors found that the immunizations they did include have prevented 154 million deaths, 95% of which would have been of children under 5 years old. In some regions, vaccination cut infant mortality in half, and the measles vaccine had the greatest effect overall on keeping children alive. And the statistics. The total number of deaths averted globally because of vaccines between 1974 and 2024, a 50-year span for selected diseases. Measles, 93.7 million. Tetanus, 27.96 million. Pertussis, 13.1 million. Tuberculosis, 10.9 million. HIV, 2.8 million. Polio, 1.6 million. And other pathogens included in the study: diphtheria, hepatitis B, Japanese encephalitis, meningitis, rotavirus, rubella, pneumonia, and yellow fever, 3.7 million. And these are the total number of deaths averted globally because of vaccines over a 50-year span. Where vaccines matter most. The relative impact on mortality varies by country, depending on how affected that country already is by a particular disease and the other major causes of diseases there. Vaccine-preventable diseases cause far fewer deaths in high-income countries, where sanitation, hygiene, nutrition, medical infrastructure, and healthcare access have already substantially improved survival. Meanwhile, vaccines have an outsized impact on preventing deaths in low- and middle-income countries, where infectious disease remains a top killer. In short, as the Lancet study authors write, vaccines promote equity by saving more lives in places where more deaths occur. And this summary of the statistics showing the success, the staggering success of vaccines, comes from the November 2024 issue of Scientific American in a special section entitled Innovations in Solutions for Health Equity. One of the biggest successes of vaccines, as noted in the previous article from Scientific American, the November 2024 issue, was the eradication of measles across the globe. In this opinion article that was posted yesterday in the Washington Post, the headline says, RFK Jr. is risking a classic mistake with the measles outbreak. The Trump administration needs to drop the denialism about measles. The article is written by Donald G. McNeil, Jr. He is a former New York Times global health reporter and is the author of The Wisdom of Plagues. If Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. doesn't quickly show more leadership, a deadly measles epidemic could be the Trump administration's first major domestic failure. As many news outlets have noted, last Wednesday, Kennedy initially seemed dismissive of the outbreak in Texas, saying it was not unusual. He backtracked in a post on X on Friday of last week, and again in a Fox News op-ed on last Sunday, saying he was deeply concerned. But as the country's top healthcare official, he has still not gone before the cameras and strongly urged the only measure that can stop this epidemic, a massive vaccination campaign. The need for that becomes more urgent as time passes. The Texas outbreak has now grown to 158 cases, probably more by today, and a separate outbreak in Ontario, Canada, halfway between Detroit and New York State, has just doubled to 146 cases, and that was this past Wednesday. Kennedy is at risk of repeating a classic mistake of scared, inexperienced health officials, denialism. By downplaying the threat instead of tackling it head-on, they lose precious time that could be used to contain it. This has been true for AIDS in Africa, COVID-19 in China, and mad cow disease in Britain. Kennedy sounded much like President Donald Trump did in early 2020, when he dreamily opined that COVID would just miraculously go away as the weather warmed. Also, Kennedy keeps referring to vitamins as an important measles treatment. That's incorrect, and it's a page right out of the anti-vaccine playbook. The anti-vaccine movement is underwritten by vitamin and supplement companies that profit by raising doubts about vaccines so they can sell their products as immune boosters. It's true that many studies have shown that vitamin A gives malnourished children in poor countries lower measles death rates. But vitamin A deficiency is rare in this country because children get it from many sources, including fortified milk and even ultra-processed sugary cereals. Supplementation is fine as long as it doesn't reach toxic levels, but the danger is that parents will be misled into thinking vitamins negate the need for shots, just as some were fatally misled during COVID into thinking that hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin were substitutes for vaccines. Kennedy should be holding news conferences and making vaccine appeals on television. During previous crises, including the 9/11 era anthrax attacks, SARS, swine flu, and Zika, successive directors of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention held regular news conferences offering public guidance. The CDC currently has no director, so it's up to Kennedy. Also, he should be on the phone heading off the next crisis that could raise its head, a vaccine shortage. For now, Texas authorities seem to be getting as many shots as they need, but ending this outbreak may take months. In 1989, before measles was declared eradicated in 2000, our last big outbreak, which also began in Texas, lasted 2 years, causing 55,000 cases and 166 deaths. Headlines about the first death are already leading to a surge in demand for vaccines in Texas, even among formerly skeptical parents. All over the country, adults are asking whether they need boosters. Here's how a shortage could emerge. About 3.6 million babies are born in the United States each year, so the market absorbs 7 million to 8 million doses annually. Children get two shots, plus a few more are needed for travelers, healthcare workers, and so on. The two companies making vaccines, Merck and GSK, have little incentive to produce more because stocks must be kept refrigerated and have expiration dates. We also normally have extra doses in the Strategic National Stockpile, but only 6 months' worth, 4 million shots. And the stockpile is imperfect, as we found out during the 2022 Mpox epidemic. We thought we had 1 million doses of smallpox vaccine stored, which also protected against Mpox, but only 72,000 were ready to inject. If demand explodes, we could be in trouble. A study done in 2022 estimated that 9 million American children and teenagers were not fully protected against measles. Religious and personal belief exemptions have only increased since then. During outbreaks, CDC guidelines say babies who normally get a first dose at 12 months can get one as early as 6 months. That adds 1.8 million doses to demand. Also, the CDC has long recommended that the 40 million Americans born between 1957 and 1968 get a booster because the killed vaccine used back then was weak. Additionally, the 75 million Americans born between 1968 and 1989 got only one measles shot as children. After the 1989-1991 epidemic, two became the norm. Also, doctors and nurses who may soon be treating people with measles will want boosters. Some have already started getting them. Someone under Kennedy's direction must immediately take stock of what vaccines we have and rationalize distribution so that anyone who has ever had even one dose is protected before others get second or third shots. And then we should seek more. The Merck and GSK vaccines are approved in many Western countries, so shipments could, in theory, be diverted here. But those countries may refuse to let that happen. Since the COVID pandemic, there has been a worldwide surge in measles. In 2023, there were 20% more cases than in 2022. There are other alternatives. The world's largest vaccine maker, the Serum Institute of India, supplies 90% of the shots bought by donors for underdeveloped countries. As of 2016, according to a 2019 study, it had made nearly 4 billion doses. Its measles vaccine isn't registered in the United States, but it has been approved by the World Health Organization since 1993. Perhaps Trump could swallow his pride and ask India to sell us what we need. At times like this, one wishes the United States were still planning to remain in the World Health Organization. Of course, American ingenuity could create a new vaccine using mRNA or other technology. But it might take too long. It would need many months of safety and efficacy testing. In any case, we need to drop the denialism and move quickly and decisively before more children die on Kennedy's and Trump's watch. What readers are saying. The comments overwhelmingly express skepticism and criticism regarding Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s ability to address the threat of measles vaccine shortages. Many commentators describe him as an anti-vaccine advocate and criticize his appointment as a dangerous choice. Listeners, please note, this is an opinion column, but the information it provides is being echoed by many, many other articles this week. This one was entitled, RFK Jr. is Risking a Classic Mistake with the Measles Outbreak. On January 22, 2025, the BBC, British Broadcasting Service, posted a thrilling tale. Giant iceberg on crash course with island, putting penguins and seals in danger. Climate and science reporter and data journalist Georgina Renard and Erwin Revolt collaborated on the story. The world's largest iceberg is on a collision course with a remote British island, potentially putting penguins and seals in danger. The iceberg is spinning northwards from Antarctica towards South Georgia, a rugged British territory and wildlife haven, where it could ground and smash into pieces. It is currently 173 miles away. Countless birds and seals died on South Georgia's icy coves and beaches when past giant icebergs stopped them feeding. Icebergs are inherently dangerous. I would be extraordinarily happy if it just completely missed us, Sea Captain Simon Wallace told the BBC News, speaking from the South Georgia government vessel, Pharos. And now, 2 days ago, the headline from BBC reads, World's largest iceberg runs aground off remote island. Again, the same reporters, Georgina and Renard, and Erwin Revolt report. The world's largest iceberg has run aground in shallow waters off the remote British island of South Georgia, home to millions of penguins and seals. The iceberg, which is about twice the size of Greater London, appears to be stuck and should start breaking up on the island's southwest shores. Fishermen fear they will be forced to battle with vast chunks of ice, and it could affect some macaroni penguins feeding in the area. But scientists in Antarctica say that huge amounts of nutrients are locked inside the ice, and that as it melts, it could create an explosion of life in the ocean. The iceberg is called A23A. It's like dropping a nutrient bomb into the middle of an empty desert, says Professor Nadine Johnston from British Antarctic Survey. Ecologist Mark Belshire, who advises the South Georgia government, said, If it breaks up, the resulting icebergs are likely to present a hazard to vessels as they move in the local currents and could restrict vessels' access to local fishing grounds. The stranding is the latest twist in an almost 40-year story that began when the mega chunk of ice broke off the Filchner-Ronne ice shelf in 1986. We have tracked its route on satellite pictures since December 2024, when it finally broke free after being trapped in an ocean vortex. As it moved north through warmer waters, nicknamed Iceberg Alley, it remained remarkably intact. For a few days, it even appeared to spin on the spot, before speeding up in mid-February, traveling at about 20 miles, or 30 kilometers, a day. The future of all icebergs is that they will die. It's very surprising to see that A23A has lasted this long, and only lost about a quarter of its area, said Hugh Griffiths, speaking to BBC News from the Sir David Attenborough Polar Research Ship, currently in Antarctica. On Saturday, the 300-meter-tall ice colossus struck the shallow continental shelf about 50 miles or 80 kilometers from land and now appears to be firmly lodged. It's probably going to stay more or less where it is until chunks break off, says Professor Andrew Measures from British Antarctic Survey. It is showing advancing signs of decay. Once 1,500 square miles in size, it has been steadily shrinking, shedding huge amounts of water as it moves into warmer seas. It is now an estimated 3,234 square kilometers, which is slightly smaller than 1,500 square miles. Instead of a big, sheer, pristine box of ice, you can see caverns under the edges. Tides will be lifting now, lifting it up and down, and where it is touching the continental shelf, it will grind backwards and forwards, eroding the rock and ice. If the ice underneath is rotten, eroded by salt, it'll crumble away under stress and maybe drift somewhere more shallow, says Professor Measures. But where the ice is touching the shelf, there are thousands of tiny creatures like coral, sea slugs, and sponge. Their entire universe is being bulldozed by a massive slab of ice scraping along the seafloor, says the professor. That is catastrophic in the short term for these species, but he says that it is a natural part of the life cycle in the region. Where it is destroying something in one place, it's providing nutrients and food in other places. And there is a graphic that shows where the iceberg calved from the Filchner ice shelf in 1986. It had been stuck on the seafloor for 30 years, and that was the point from which it traveled. It traveled south in 2022, and then in 2023, it made rapid progress along the seafloor ridge. In 2024, it began to rotate on a water column for 8 months, and then finally, its latest position on March 3rd, 2025, was right next to South Georgia Island. There had been fears for the island's larger creatures. In 2004, an iceberg in a different area called the Ross Sea affected the breeding success of penguins, leading to a spike in deaths. But experts now think that most of South Georgia's birds and animals will escape that fate. Some macaroni penguins that forage on the shelf where the iceberg is stuck could be affected, says Peter Fretwell at the British Antarctic Survey. The iceberg melts fresh water into salt water, reducing the amount of food, including krill, a small crustacean that penguins eat. The birds can move to other feeding grounds, he explains, but that would put them in competition with other creatures. The ice could block harbors or disrupt sailing when the fishing season starts in April. This will be the most ice from an iceberg we will have ever dealt with in a fishing season, but we are well prepared and resourced, says Andrew Newman from Argos Froyans. But scientists working in Antarctica currently are also discovering the incredible contributions that icebergs make to ocean life. Professor Griffiths and Professor Johnston are working on the Sir David Attenborough ship, collecting evidence of what their team believe is a huge flow of nutrients from ice in Antarctica across Earth. Particles and nutrients from around the world get trapped into the ice, which is then slowly released into the ocean, the scientists explain. Without ice, we wouldn't have these ecosystems. They are some of the most productive in the world and support huge numbers of species and individual animals, and feed the biggest animals in the world, like the blue whale, says Professor Griffiths. A sign that this nutrient release has started around A23A will be when vast phytoplankton blossom around the iceberg. It would look like a vast green halo around the ice, visible from satellite pictures over the next weeks and months. The life cycle of icebergs is a natural process, but climate change is expected to create more icebergs as Antarctica warms and becomes more unstable. More could break away from the continent's vast ice sheets and melt at quicker rates, disrupting patterns of wildlife and fishing in the region. This latest update on the progress of iceberg A23A was reported by the BBC on March 6, 2025. Next, the February 2025 issue of Science News recounts a different story of oceans and marine life. From Environment, in the news department, "The Blob Killed Millions of Seabirds" by Jake Bueller. The tall, stony coastlines along the Northeast Pacific Ocean are much quieter than they were just a decade ago. Following a punishing marine heat wave in the region, the raucous seabird colonies that once crowded the sea cliffs are now greatly thinned to a quarter of their former size in some places. This abrupt loss of millions of birds may be the largest wildlife mortality event recorded in modern times, researchers reported in the journal Science. "We knew the population decline was big, but the numbers are a gut punch," says Heather Renner, a wildlife biologist with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service at the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge in Homer. The story began in late 2014 when a brutal marine heat wave nicknamed the Blob parked itself over the Northeast Pacific, raising ocean temperatures far above normal for almost 2 years. The colossal cauldron cooked up an ecological chain reaction, slashing phytoplankton populations and, in turn, the fish that seabirds like common murres eat. In 2015 and 2016, the birds starved to death en masse. Renner runs a monitoring program spanning the region's coastline that has been collecting data on seabirds for the last 50 years. The scale of the toll was immediately obvious. "We knew right away that it was a big catastrophe," Renner says. "There were 62,000 carcasses that washed up on the beaches, all over the Gulf of Alaska, all the way down to California. It was clearly a big deal, but we couldn't really quantify the size of the mortality very well." To get a better idea of the full impact on the murre population, the team used colony count data from 1995 to 2022, gathered across 13 colonies along the coast and on islands in the Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska. After getting bird counts before and after the heat wave, the team then extrapolated those results to the entire Alaskan murre population. Renner and colleagues estimate that the heat wave killed 4 million murres in the Gulf of Alaska and eastern Bering Sea. About half of Alaska's murres died in a single winter. "It was just so much worse than we thought," Renner says. "The loss is the largest die-off of wildlife, specifically non-fish vertebrates, yet reported in the modern era," the team suggests. In another heat wave a few years earlier, some 10 billion snow crabs in the Bering Sea died from starvation. The sheer scale and speed of the common murre population collapse is shocking, says ecologist Simon Tai of the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. The before and after pictures of the colonies are pretty heartbreaking. The fact that the birds hadn't rebounded even 7 years later helps reject a hypothesis that the birds were just temporarily delaying breeding to wait out the hostile conditions. The stubbornly sparse colonies may mean that something fundamental has changed in the ecosystem and can't support a return to past Muir numbers. Renner doesn't think climactic impacts spurring such a dramatic, swift shift have been previously documented. The findings show such intense changes can occur on the scale of years. Tai and Renner both point out that with continued climate warming, heat waves like the blob are expected to occur more frequently. This could imperil already vulnerable populations of many animals that have yet to recover from the previous heat wave. And this article, "The Blob Killed Millions of Seabirds," appears in the February 2025 issue of Science News. Continuing in this same issue, from the Department of Health and Medicine, the latest news, "What Science Says About Alcohol's Link to Cancer," by Amy Cunningham. In January, the U.S. Surgeon General released a report on the link between drinking alcohol and developing cancer. It may have surprised many people. Although evidence for this link has been growing for some time, less than half of Americans are aware of the association, according to a 2019 study. That's in contrast to tobacco, which 89% of the survey respondents identified as a cancer risk. The report puts the link between drinking alcohol and developing 7 different types of cancer, including esophagus, breast, liver, and colorectal, in the spotlight to increase awareness. The report also calls for adding information about cancer risk to warning labels on alcohol, and it recommends health professionals discuss the risk, which generally increases the more one drinks, with patients and the public. That way, people can take the risk into account in choosing whether or how much to drink. Here's an overview of what scientists know about the association between alcohol and cancer, and what they still need to learn. The World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer first classified alcoholic beverages as carcinogenic in 1988. That designation is based on studies finding an association between drinking alcohol and 7 types of cancer: mouth, throat, voice box, esophagus, breast, liver, and colorectal. Researchers have identified the association through observational studies, which compares groups of people in the real world rather than a controlled setting. Generally, the observational studies compare different groups of people over time in terms of the amount they drink and their health. Such studies need to account for other factors that can contribute to cancer risk, such as smoking and age. The association persists for drinking alcohol even after considering those factors and other health behaviors, says Elisa Bandera, a cancer epidemiologist at the Rutgers Cancer Institute in New Brunswick, New Jersey. One challenge with these types of studies is getting accurate information about drinking patterns, including binge drinking and lifetime consumption of alcohol, Bandera says. The studies tend to rely on self-reporting. Because alcohol may be perceived as an unhealthy behavior by some, there is potential for under-reporting the actual amount consumed, leading to potential inaccuracies in the data, she says. Some analyses combine data from multiple studies to report estimates of how many cases of cancer are tied to drinking alcohol. For example, alcohol contributed to an estimated 54,000 cancer cases in women and 42,000 in men in the U.S. in 2019, researchers reported in CA, a cancer journal for clinicians, in 2024. An estimated 741,000, that's about 4% of all new cancer cases worldwide, were attributable to alcohol in 2020, some of the same researchers reported in the journal Lancet Oncology in 2021. Most of those cases were cancers of the esophagus, liver, and breast. The vast majority of the total of new cancer cases were tied to drinking the equivalent of two or more drinks per day. Another analysis that combined 572 studies and more than 486,000 cases of cancer looked at the relative risk of developing cancer. Overall, the risk increased with heavier drinking. Developing cancer in the esophagus, for example, is about 1.3 times as likely with light drinking, which the study defined as less than one drink per day on average, than with not drinking. That grows to nearly 5 times as likely with heavy drinking, defined as more than 4 drinks per day, compared with not drinking. Esophagus cancer is at the high end of the relative risk spectrum. For female breast cancer, the risk was slightly elevated with light drinking and about 1.6 times as likely for heavy drinking compared with not drinking, researchers reported in the British Journal of Cancer in 2014. Scientists are still working out how alcohol can contribute to cancer risk. They have a few theories. With the help of enzymes, the body breaks down alcohol into acetaldehyde. This chemical can damage DNA, which may lead to unchecked cell growth. The process of breaking down alcohol can also lead to the formation of molecules called reactive oxygen species, which can increase inflammation and harm DNA. Some research has suggested that drinking alcohol is associated with increased levels of estrogen, which could help explain the link between alcohol and breast cancer risk. More research is needed on how alcohol contributes to cancer development, says Joy Freudenheim, a cancer epidemiologist at the University at Buffalo in New York. That's especially true for the effect of light to moderate drinking, she says. Studies on the association between drinking and cancer risk tend to discuss the risk in terms of the amount of alcohol per day on average. So an average of 7 drinks per week could mean 1 drink per day or 3 to 4 drinks on each of 2 days. The second pattern probably has a different biological impact than the first does, Freudenheim says, but we need more information about that. Overall, the data suggest that any alcohol consumption increases cancer risk to some extent, Freudenheim says. I think it's important for people to know what their risks are. That means they can look at the data and decide, I am willing to take on this amount of risk, she says. Freudenheim finds Canada's guidance on alcohol and health useful in that regard. It discusses the risk of cancer and other health harms based on the number of drinks a person has per week. And this What Science Says About Alcohol's Link to Cancer report in the Department of Health and Medicine appears in the 2025 Science News issue for February. And the news featured in Materials Science in this same issue of Science News: Record-thin pasta could dress wounds, by Skylar Ware. The new record holder for world's thinnest pasta may not be destined for the dinner table. A new starchy fiber made from bleached flour averages 370 nanometers thick, about 200 times as thin as a human hair. The fiber could be used in biodegradable bandages, scientists reported in Nanoscale Advances. Chemist Adam Clancy of University College London and colleagues made a dough by mixing formic acid into flour, which uncoiled the flour's starch molecules. Warming the dough made it suitable for pulling through a needle and onto a plate using an electric charge. The molecules tangled with each other as they left the needle, forming a continuous jet. As the jet flew through the air and onto the plate, the acid evaporated, resulting in a fiber that, after about 30 minutes, formed a mat. Starchy nanofiber mats typically have pores that are too small for bacteria to enter, making them attractive options for bandages, the team says. Since the fiber is flour-based, it qualifies as pasta. That makes it the thinnest on record, 1/1000th the width of sous filin de yew, a pasta about 1/2 the width of angel hair that's exclusively handmade by just one family in Italy. But is the new nano pasta edible? I certainly hope so, Clancy says. Next, the latest news in particle physics. Physicists are building telescopes under the sea, by Emily Conover. Deploying a telescope in space is one thing. Making two of them deep underwater is a task in a league of its own. On a ship bobbing in the Mediterranean Sea, physicists, not typically known for their sea legs, brave week-long voyages and rough waters, working around the clock to deploy the telescope's detectors. The telescopes are designed to detect not starlight, but neutrinos. These subatomic particles are spewed at high energies from mysterious, unidentified realms of space. Such high-energy neutrinos are so rare and so stealthy that the detectors that study them must be enormous. So scientists are outfitting a cubic kilometer of the Mediterranean with light-collecting devices designed to snag them. It's weird if you think about that. We want to do astronomy, and to look at the universe, we place a telescope underwater, says physicist Simone Biaggi of the National Institute for Nuclear Physics in Catania, Italy. The Cubic Kilometer Neutrino Telescope, or KM3NET, consists of two telescopes made up of glass baubles arranged on vertical cables. Each strand dangles in the water like a pearl necklace that's up to 700 meters long. Each bauble, a pressure-resistant sphere 44 centimeters wide, contains 31 photomultiplier tubes that sense light generated when neutrinos crash into the water. The researchers deploy detectors in one month-long campaign every year. At the end of the last campaign, in October 2024, the telescopes boasted 57 strands. Eventually, hundreds of such cables will sway in the currents, a few kilometers below the surface, off the coasts of Sicily and the south of France. It's really like a forest, an underwater forest in the total black, because we are in the abyss, says astroparticle physicist Daniele Vivolo of the University of Luigi Vanvitelli in Italy. The Sicilian telescope is designed to study high-energy neutrinos from space. The French one will study neutrinos from the atmosphere to understand how they oscillate or change from one type of neutrino to another. The concept is similar to the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory at the South Pole, which searches for light flashes in ice rather than liquid water. Scientists are already using the partially completed telescopes to search for effects of quantum gravity on neutrinos and measuring neutrino oscillations. During deployment campaigns, scientists must be at the absolute top of their game. Every second on the ship costs approximately a dollar, Biaggi says. If you lose 1 hour doing stupid things, this has an impact on the cost. Weary from sleeping odd hours, perhaps seasick, they must make critical decisions if something goes wrong, be it with the devices or unfavorable weather. A crane on the ship lowers each strand, spooled up in a roughly 2-meter-wide launching structure, to the seabed. A remotely operated vehicle plunges down to inspect the equipment. With the pull of a handle by the submersible, the strand begins to unfurl. A buoy floats the strand upward, and the device spins to release the baubles, like a fern frond opening. Back on shore, other researchers check the device's performance. Any issues must be dealt with immediately. Once a strand is planted in the forest, there's no adjusting or fiddling with connections. It's like sending something to the moon, Biaggi says. Everything must be in perfect working order at the outset. One analogy, it seems, is not enough. The telescope is like a forest, a pearl necklace, fern leaves, and spacecraft bound for the moon. Typically, physicists find creative ways to answer complicated questions, Biaggi says. That quest has brought the scientists to other strange locales, including the South Pole and deep underground in mines. Life in the Mediterranean isn't so bad in comparison. Sunsets and beautiful beaches come with the territory. And that's nothing to complain about. And that's the report from Particle Physics on physicists building telescopes under the sea. And from the department, The Health Checkup, Sleep Remains a Medical Mystery by Laura Sanders. So many of us struggle to fall asleep and stay there through the night. About a third of U.S. adults don't sleep enough. Teenagers' sleep is even worse. 8 in 10 teens are sleep deprived. Our collective exhaustion isn't good for us. Lack of sleep can come with a range of health problems. Our immune systems, hormones, hearts, maybe all the body's major systems, are influenced by sleep. In the brain, our memory, creativity, and ability to learn are, too. But for something so entwined with our health, the actual jobs of sleep are still, in many ways, a mystery. Scientists have tons of ideas. Perhaps sleep is for rifling through memories and choosing which ones to keep. Or maybe it's a quiet time, still time, for growing bones in children. Or maybe it's a time to let the brain loose on whatever problem vexed you that day. One delightfully myopic theory posits that sleep, especially the rapid eye movement stage, is for squeezing fluid around to keep the eye lubricated. Figuring out why we sleep has puzzled scientists for as long as the question has existed. It's like following hundreds of disappearing breadcrumbs on paths through a forest of trees that keep shifting spots, only to realize you're standing alone in your underwear. Oh, and you forgot to study for the test. Given this hazy scientific landscape, it's no surprise that efforts to help the sleep-deprived catch some Z's might fall short or have unintended consequences. That's clear from a study of the sleep medicine Zolpidem. Zolpidem, sold as Ambien, messes with another possible job of sleep, housekeeping. Every 20 seconds or so, a wave of cerebrospinal fluid pulses through the sleeping brain. Scientists suspect these rhythmic pulses clear out waste, including the sticky proteins that accumulate in Alzheimer's disease. This brain wash is sort of like running the dishwasher overnight, says neuroscientist Maiken Nittergaard, who helped discover the system. Washing up isn't a flashy job, but an important one that hasn't been fully appreciated. Mice on Zolpidem fall asleep faster and sleep deeper than naturally sleeping mice, says Nettergaard of the University of Rochester in New York. But they had less power washing, her team recently reported in the journal Cell. Scientists don't yet know if this also happens in humans or what the consequences might be, but the results point out potential pitfalls in our attempts to kickstart sleep. Zolpidem targets GABA, a chemical messenger that sends hush signals. That means it's shutting down everything in your brain, says MIT sleep scientist Robert Stickgold. It's a powerful blunt force tool. Ambien-assisted sleep may be justifiable for short stretches, says Nettergaard, but long-term use brings considerable side effects. The brain-cleaning disruption may be one. We need a new sleep aid that gets people to sleep but preserves these oscillations, she says. Scientists aren't just trying to help people sleep better. They're also pushing the limits of what sleeping brains can accomplish. Scientists can instruct a sleeping person to dream about particular objects like trees, sharpen their piano playing skills, and maybe even learn new languages. These feats are impressive, but may involve trade-offs, Stickgold warns. If you're forcing that sleeping brain to do something specific, then you're getting less of something else, he says. We have to assume that something else is there for a reason. Humility is the way forward to understanding and tinkering with a system as complex as the sleeping brain. So maybe we shouldn't expect one simple answer to the question of why we sleep. It could be for growing bones, sharpening memories, cleaning the brain, and many more tasks. In the years to come, we'll no doubt find new clues about how sleep keeps our bodies and minds healthy. And these scientific breadcrumbs may lead us to yet more mysteries. And that's the health checkup in Science News, February 2025. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.